What should we doing? I don't know what to do either. Are you starting the script or am I starting? What are we doing? Do you welcome everybody?
Well, hello there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. Is this awful?
This is awful.
Yeah.
A podcast. Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. Welcome.
Awful intro. Awful podcast. All of the above.
Yeah. I'm Trevor, a very awful host.
And I'm Allison. I usually host and tell a true crime story, but this week we are mixing it up.
By mixing it up, you mean I'm in charge.
Yeah.
And like with many things in my life, when I'm in charge, that just means all the rules go out the window and it's sloppy. Yep, that's what's happening. So, do we have any business we need to talk about?
No, I did add our new spooky Halloween design to you can't just say it's spooky and
you have to go sad. Spooky. You have to go spooky.
But yeah, it's live in the shop. It's cute. I like it. I believe there's a sale right now for either 15% off or maybe 20% off.
Go check out those.
Yeah. Tell me what our sale is.
Those spooky designs. Get some stuff for cheap. That's at shop.spreadshirt.com /this-is-awful-podcast. There's a spider descending from our ceiling.
This is the spookiest podcast ever.
It's right in front of Allison. You're going to have to do something, Allison. Why are you?
Oh, he's just little. It's not his fault. I'll blow him over to you.
What am I going to do with him?
I don't know. It's your problem.
He's going to get on your desk.
It's okay. He can catch bugs.
All right. Well, there he is. Anyway, go and buy some stuff from our shop. We don't make any money on this podcast. We decided back in the beginning of this that we didn't want to profit off of other people's stories and stuff like that. So any money that comes in from the shop is based on Allison's designs and everything just goes towards us keeping the lights on here. And if you want to,
for our causes.
Yeah, if you want to donate towards our causes of the week and become a Patreon and support us, you can do that at patreon.com/thisisawfulpod.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, any other news?
No, I mean, nah.
Okay. Well, as a blanket disclaimer, it's a true crime podcast. We talk about bad things happening to people, usually good people, which makes it worse somehow. This episode specifically, we'll talk about murder and abuse, and that's not fun. So, yeah, disclaimer. And if we get into any details, I'll try to throw a disclaimer.
Yeah, we do try
to
give a heads up just in case.
Anyway, this week's episode is about a story I think almost every single person who has any interest in true crime has heard.
Okay.
But we're not talking about the case specifically. We'll go over it fairly briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll discuss implications from it and some myths that permeate to this day inside true crime and pop psychology.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
All right. Do you know anything about Kitty Genovese?
Yeah, but I don't know why I know that name.
Okay, you'll know it when I start talking about the case. But let me bring this up so I can give you some stuff. First, sources.
Sources!
Yeah. WashingtonPost.com, okay. The New Yorker.com, History.com, Wikipedia, and a documentary called The Witness.
Okay. Okay.
It was produced by Kitty's brother, or it was made by, not just produced, he's 100% of everything behind it, pretty much. Yeah, her brother William. Okay. Anyway, on March 27th of 1964, New York Times led with a front page story that said 37 witnesses watched her get murdered and did nothing.
That's, yes, okay. I remember hearing this.
The first paragraph. For more than an hour or half an hour, 38 respectable law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens. Not one person telephoned the police during the assault. One witness called after the woman was dead. That's the first paragraph of the story.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you know how much of that is true?
I mean, guessing from your tone, I'm going to say not much of it, but that's just because context clues.
I'll tell you, law-abiding citizens, they were present.
True. Okay.
Yes. a woman was stabbed in Kew Gardens, Queens.
Okay.
That's it. That's the truth.
Okay. Well,
in all of that, in the headline, in the first paragraph, that's how much was true.
I think you're supposed to have more that's true.
You would hope.
When you write articles for newspapers.
You would hope. The editor that published, or like was over the story and later became like one of the head editors of the New York Times, when interviewed about this multiple times, has been like, well, it did sell papers.
That's okay.
Yep. Anyway, so some backstory to how this even started, this story got out there.
Let's talk about
how this headline and this paragraph, before we even talk about Kitty.
Oh,
okay. Let's talk about how that happened.
Okay.
So, just before that, on about the 23rd of March, that editor was having lunch with a police captain.
Mm-hmm.
And the captain was like, wow, this Queens case is sure nuts.
Okay.
You know, we interviewed like 38 witnesses, and the only way we caught this guy is because we found out a guy was stealing TVs, and his car matched the description of this other case, and when we asked him about it, he just admitted to doing it.
Okay, so
that's what he told.
That's the source.
Newspaper guy goes,
I can run
a whole bunch of people, you say, and a murder? Done. That's
what he filled in the blanks after that.
Pretty much.
That's not how. No, you don't. You fill in the blanks by doing research. So, you don't fill in the blanks by making. It's not Mad Libs.
Yeah. So, I mean, the story was spoken to him about having caught the guy who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was stealing TVs, which is something he had a penchant for doing.
Okay.
And
a hobby.
Yeah. And his car matched the description from this other case.
But how would they have known what the car looked like if nobody told police?
Yeah. Well,
he wouldn't have even known that.
So here's let's get into Kitty's story.
Okay.
At 2:30 in the morning on March 13th, so about 2 weeks before the article comes out, Kitty Genovese was locking up a bar in Queens, New York, where she managed and bartended, got into her red Fiat, and drove back to Brooklyn. Or sorry, her Brooklyn bar drove back to Queens.
Oh, okay.
To be with her girlfriend, Marianne Zlonko.
Okay.
Kitty was 28. She's described as being funny and smart. She was a bartender that was well known for being tough and well liked. And she was able to cut off drunk patrons without them getting upset. She managed the bar very, very well. The owner was kind of an absentee owner, and she came in as a bartender running the place.
What a freaking badass.
Yeah. She grew up in Brooklyn. In high school, she was voted as class cut up. She was super well liked in school. Like the class clown, the class cut.
Oh, yeah. I've never heard that term before.
This is, you know, back in the 1950s.
Yeah,
you
okay. Know. She was this cool in the 1970s?
No, 1950s. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, she was awesome. She's like everyone has, I mean, obviously.
People who can be kind
and
tough.
Yeah.
That's such a like difficult balance to maintain.
She's like in everything I have read about her. She's kind of a badass of just being like she was headstrong and independent and just wanted to do her thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody just loved her. Her mother witnessed a murder right as she was graduating high school, and her parents decided to get out of the city and move to Connecticut. But because she had just graduated and she loved the city, she stayed behind.
This poor family.
She stayed with her grandparents and was then briefly engaged and got married to a guy, and then they added a little while later. And then she just started making her way in the world.
Yeah.
She wanted to own a restaurant. She came from a big Irish Catholic or Italian Catholic family.
Okay.
Wanted to own an Italian restaurant. That was her dream. She was, you know, working her way up as a bartender and managing bars to kind of get her foot in the door.
Get into the field.
Yeah. So on her way home from work, Kitty parked near her apartment at a nearby train station around 3:15, and she was walking to her building when she became aware that a man was following her from behind. So she started running towards her building. But before she could get there, he caught up to her and stabbed her twice. One of those stabbing her in the lung. She did scream out. And witnesses say that at least one neighbor called out from their apartment, saying, "Hey, get away from her," or something like that.
Trying to just distract him.
And the guy ran off.
Okay.
In subsequent interviews with many, many witnesses, this is at 3 a.m. So a lot of them is like, "I heard something at my window."
Yeah, but we hear things outside sometimes. We're like, probably the cat, you know.
I saw something. There were a couple people that, you know, were awakened by her scream. They thought it was a domestic dispute or someone was drunk.
Which is also sad, because even if it's a domestic dispute, you still, that but still needs help.
Guy hollers out and they see man run away.
Okay,
and
then so they think, oh, okay.
She's on her feet and kind of stumbling and holding herself up on the wall. So a lot of people, or I shouldn't say a lot, the few witnesses that saw that
what part happened
assumed that she may have been drunk and was making her way home still. Oh. There was someone that tried to call the police at that first initial thing, but this is before 911.
Yeah.
So you call the operator connects you to the nearest precinct, the precinct puts a log into the book, radios out.
Maybe somebody shows up, maybe somebody doesn't.
Yeah. Now, according to the New York Times article, the police said they showed up within 2 minutes.
Okay.
Of when someone called. But let's put that on the back burner because there's still a lot more to go.
I think that that's unrealistic.
So Kitty's still alive, but her lungs punctured. She's not able to make a lot of sounds. She's holding herself up. So she makes her way towards, you know, trying to get into her building. And her attacker goes and gets into his car. According to most accounts, he like moves his car and he's in it for about 10 minutes. And then he comes back to find her. He does find her. She's like collapsed in a vestibule just inside one of the entrances to her apartment building. And he then continues to stab her and assault her. During that time, a neighbor opens their door and sees what's going on and closes it quickly. And he runs off. Okay?
Yeah.
Did
they call for help? Did that neighbor call?
So there's a lot of story to get to here. So about that time, or a short while later, because, I mean, the timing's a little bit murky. A lot of people say the attack was over a half hour. But there's no real timing to that.
Yeah.
A neighbor comes out of her apartment, runs downstairs. It's this woman that's described as super, super feisty. It's a housewife that lives in the building. Comes downstairs. She's like 4'11". Just no regard for whether or not the attacker's still there. Finds like Kitty and holds her until an ambulance comes. But unfortunately, Kitty dies on her way to the hospital.
That really is so sad.
Yeah. It's a pretty disturbing attack. It's one of those ones that it sticks out in people's minds.
Especially because she could have, like, if somebody would have just come downstairs and checked on her.
Yeah. Her the first two stab wounds were non-fatal, though she wouldn't have been able to, like, cry out much after that.
Yeah.
And the sensationalized versions of a lot of stories. It's hard to sift through the crap because it's so sensationalized because of the New York Times article that later turns into this frenzy. Because a lot of times people will be like, oh, and she screamed and called for help and was begging her neighbors to come out. But most medical experts said after
she can't.
Her lung was punctured.
Yeah.
She's barely able to get enough oxygen to stay conscious for most of that. And she dies from asphyxiation because the stab wound to her lung. Even though she invented, after the second attack, she has over 12 stab wounds.
Oh my gosh.
With many of them being defensive wounds. So it's a pretty disturbing attack. What a lot of people latched onto because of the New York Times article was that neighbors didn't do anything.
Which I get, because I'm going to say, I understand the, it is easy to just, like, we hear a crash outside and we're like, freaking raccoon in the garbage, you know, like.
Oh, yeah.
But people who saw that there was an altercation.
Yeah.
For me, and I understand that there's the risk, like, it's scary to be like, well, if he's going to come back and pick a fight with me. But at the same time, I don't think I would be able to sleep if I couldn't go down and just make sure. I heard there was a turtle that was lost outside today, and I went and looked for it because I was like, it's going to get so cold. I don't understand being able to detach quite that much.
Well, so there's a few things that I think people latch onto because of this. So just leaving with that part of the story, which mm-hmm. is very few details, but that's like the most accurate-ish description of how the events actually unfolded in like a brief overview. The
clearest parts of what happened. Yeah. Okay.
Trying to decipher through so much sensationalized stuff. Mm-hmm. And I really, really recommend anyone go watch The Witness. I think it's on Hulu. People say that it's more compelling even than like Serial, the podcast and stuff, as far as watching her brother kind of sit through
all this.
I would
like to watch this. Yeah.
But what gets really picked up with this story, it becomes a sensation in the newspaper, but also psychologists shortly thereafter went to study this, what gets determined the bystander effect because of the 38 witnesses claim.
Mm-hmm.
And so this story, mostly the sensationalized story from the New York Times, gets put in a whole bunch of psychology books, like intro to psychology books that are taught in high school and college.
Yeah.
So the story is like super misrepresented and spreads very, very widely.
Yeah.
It starts the phrase of kind of this like non or this like urban apathy movement. People like saying that people in big cities can like literally watch you die in front of them. They will not care. They'll just step over the dead body and keep going, kind of a thing.
Well, yeah, that's definitely dramatic.
And I think what one of the things is, people don't know New York City very well. Mm-hmm. So when they hear New York City, they don't know what Queens is and how different that is. The building that she's in front of, her apartment building, and then this, the Q neighborhood, spelled K-E-W, or Q Gardens. It's like mixed-use shopping and apartments.
Mm-hmm.
Her building specifically was like shops on the bottom, and it's all just second-story apartments. Not much bigger than that. Most of the buildings around there are, at the time, are two or three stories. They're not large apartment buildings. They're like smaller block and row houses and apartment buildings.
Isn't it like most of the like TV shows that are set in Queens and they have like those cute bars and stuff like that?
Yeah,
it's that like, neighborhood,
it's like,
right?
It's that kind of stuff. Like, you know, the higher end neighborhoods will be, you know, walk up brownstone kind of areas, and then everything else is mixed use. It's not skyscrapers. It's not, you know, what in the 70s, like a couple decades later would be the urban decay kind of thing in other areas. It's not quite that. This is a very like more close-knit neighborhood that has very little crime.
Everybody knows each other because you all live to like very close together.
So one of the big things is it's 3 a.m. So most of the witnesses that are interviewed by police and later by the newspaper are ear witnesses, not eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. It's people saying, I heard something, didn't know what it was, I didn't go and do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's housewives who were like, I woke up, shook my husband awake, told him I didn't want him to get involved, but to like lock the door, kind of a thing. They're just scared because they heard something in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You know? The first attack is on the street, but this is streets that don't have many lights on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really
dark. Because people are sleeping.
Just there's not streetlights in the area at that time. There's a couple, but it's not like it's a broad daylight attack or something. This is in the middle of the night. People thought it was drunk people getting home. And unfortunately, it was also during a time where, like, with domestic abuse.
Yeah.
Where it was kind of one of those things like,
as like, well, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout at the guy to like leave her alone, but you're not going to intervene because
that would be his girlfriend.
Yeah. That would be kind of a social moray they weren't willing to like confront at that time. But another thing with this is there's two big witnesses that kind of get villainized the most.
Yeah.
One is a assistant superintendent of the building across the street
who
said he saw her get attacked, just that she was attacked. And he thought about going and getting a baseball bat to protect his building, but just went downstairs and took a nap instead.
Okay. Wait, he saw her get stabbed?
He saw her get attacked. Because you're talking about he's across the street inside the building.
And it's dark.
And this guy jumped on her, stabbed her twice real quick. someone shouted out when she yelled, and then he ran off. It's not like he watched for minutes.
Yeah.
He watched for something that took, you know, probably 30 seconds to happen.
It's different when if he had known she was stabbed versus it just seemed like, you know, she got scared by this guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's difficult to know the difference.
It's a hard one because I see him getting villainized a lot. And my first thought is, one, it's not like he's staring at the point of what's happening and knowing what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a movie.
It's 3 a.m. and there's just a couple people outside. He's across the street.
He probably checked on this person's walking home, mm-hmm. just looked up from whatever he was doing real quick and maybe saw someone run up and hit her in some way. Doesn't know exactly what's going on. And he doesn't bother to get necessarily involved, but he definitely knows something was wrong. He absolutely could have helped and didn't.
Yeah.
But with that first attack, someone did try to call the police.
Yeah, that's true. And it's not a random citizen's job to go down and confront the situation. It's the people who are paid to go supposedly protect and serve.
Yeah, and what gets a lot of people's things is that he says he went and took a nap instead. And I don't think that's one of those things
where it's 3 a.m. He's going to sleep.
And I think it's kind of like he's disassociating. It's not my problem. I don't. In the middle of the night, you're going to kind of she's still walking. She's stumbling, holding onto the building. But for someone she's that's
still moving. Yeah.
That's not, you're just watching from across the street in your job. I kind of sit there and go I think a lot of people probably would more than you would expect. Walk
for a minute and be like, okay, it's going to be fine. She's just drunk.
Yeah.
Getting home.
I'm not. She probably got her purse stolen or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not getting too involved. And in the middle of the night, maybe I'm just going to lock this door and go away, you know, and it sucks. But I think more people than you'd expect probably have that situation of I don't know if there's help I can really render. I don't know if there's help needed. And
so I'll just mind my business.
I'm going to mind my business.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other witness is the one that
yelled
during the second attack.
Oh, that opened the door and shut it again.
Yeah. So that guy's name is Carl Ross. He was actually friends with Kitty because that vestibule that she was attacked in leads up to four or five apartments right there.
Their goes little up neighborhood, to a little basically.
Net landing. It's also where the woman that ran downstairs and helped her.
Mm-hmm.
That's where she was. I keep forgetting to mention her name and I need to look at my notes so I can. Sophia Farrar is who came and helped her. But they all are kind of neighbors in that area. And he would go and drink with her and her girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
He was gay. They were the lesbian couple next door.
Mm-hmm.
But at this time in New York City, it wasn't safe to be out, really.
Yeah,
you were out with just the
people. With your people that you know are safe. Yeah.
So in a lot of the early reporting, Kitty's girlfriend is only referred to as a roommate.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't publish that she was in a romantic relationship with a woman. Of course not. But the police knew.
Mm-hmm.
And when they, their first person they suspected was her girlfriend. And they questioned her for 6 hours about it. Mostly about what their relationship was about. Getting into very sexual questions with her.
Ew.
And she was their number one suspect. Thinking it was a domestic dispute. How
bad at your job can you be?
Yeah. But Carl Ross, who saw that,
mm-hmm.
was described as being a very, very timid person.
Mm-hmm.
Someone that was kind of a recluse, mm-hmm. and an alcoholic. He would kind of just stay in his apartment and drink. He didn't go out and do a whole lot. He would come over and drink with them sometimes. And after he witnessed it, he called one of his friends to find out what he should do. They said just stay out of it. So he was kind of scared of being alone.
He was just scared.
Left out of his apartment and walked across the roof to another person's house.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it was that he went to Sophia's.
Or somebody who knew Sophia or something. Or
I think he may have used his friend's phone to call Sophia. And Sophia told him to call the police. And then ran down the stairs.
Okay, and so he's Kitty. Yeah, he did reach out for help in the way that he was able to reach out for help.
He's not someone that's gonna.
But he apparently is not. And
he opened his door because he was scared.
Yeah,
saw his friend being attacked, and is someone that isn't going to be able to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't feel that, like, he would just get attacked too if he came out his door, was his thing. And I think for a lot of people that are not physically imposing, that are very timid,
yeah,
in a situation like that, it's horrifying. You know, I think everyone wants to think of themselves the hero, that they would, like, grab their bear mace and run out and start attacking. But I think in real life, there's plenty of people where that's so frightening, you would just shut your door and try to call a friend and find out what to do.
Yeah.
You need reassurance that you can help.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. So at that point, because a lot of people villainize him in a way, and I want to say, like,
that would be extremely, that would be so traumatizing just to, like, it is also entirely possible that he just flat out dissociated the second he saw what was happening, because what are you supposed to do with that?
The reason that he was awake
is your friend
too, is he was drinking all night.
Yeah.
He was very drunk.
Yeah.
He's drunk and scared. Lots of people in that situation. You know, like, yeah, if you've been in a bar when there's someone that, like, starts a fight, most of the people in that room just shrink into the corners, mm-hmm, because you don't know what to do and you're not in a mental space to be able to do anything.
Yeah.
So I don't think that he should be villainized mm-hmm, and blamed in the way that he is. I also, it's one of those hard things because people want to question why he didn't call the police right away.
But well, he's also a gay man, and it, like,
yeah,
he knows that's not necessarily going to be helpful. Even when they did show up, they didn't help. They showed up too late to do anything, and then they further victimized this poor woman's girlfriend.
Yeah,
who was obviously overwhelmed by grief, because you can't not be.
So yeah. After
what good is it going to do? That's so frustrating. Called the
police, and Sophia was with Kitty. Mm-hmm. He went and was with Mary, her girlfriend, mm-hmm, and sat and drank with her.
Mm-hmm.
But the details are kind of weird because people fixate on, like, he didn't tell her that he saw her being attacked, didn't tell her girlfriend that he saw her being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would tell someone right away, because that's not the time you say, by the way, I opened my door and saw it happening. Yeah. No, you're not going to tell their loved one that you watched it happen.
Well, and that's a lot of really people don't process trauma until a long time after anyways.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible he wasn't even ready to, like, this is what I witnessed.
Well, and I think his role then was he was already drunk.
Mm-hmm.
He went over there to try to the best he can to console and support her.
Yeah.
And to drink.
Better than because the freaking he had his cops own trauma. Did.
So those are the stories that kind of get, you know, latched onto. Those two witness accounts get really, really villainized with it. But it talks a lot about the apathy part, you know, where people are like, oh, in these big cities, they'll literally just look out, see you being attacked, they won't do anything.
Well, but
stories are a lot more complex than that.
Well, and even here in Park City, like a week ago maybe, there was an altercation between a guy and one of the, like, people that was renting a room in his house, and they were drunk and there were guns involved, and one of the guys got shot, and they had gone outside to fight, like, to argue, and people had seen them go outside and argue, and then one came back and the other didn't, and one had a gunshot wound and one had been killed with a gun. So it's like, put two and two together. That's in Park City, Utah.
Yeah.
where, like, it's a pretty small town. Like, everybody knows everybody pretty well.
Yeah.
And even there, like, it's not that it's a big city and people are apathetic. It was in the wee hours of the morning, and people are mostly just trying to sleep. Maybe they hear something. They're like, oh, kids lighting off fireworks again, you know?
Yeah.
I can see how it would be easy to dismiss those things.
Yeah.
Because you literally cannot always exist in a space where you assume every sound is a horrible crime.
Yeah.
And that's an unhealthy way to live. You shouldn't live that way.
It's one of those things where, for people that aren't in the United States, you might not know about this, but there's a lot of times in cities like Los Angeles where people will talk about the joke of, is it fireworks or is it a gunshot? Especially around the 4th of July. for Independence Day. And while that's a joke, especially on social media, of, oh, it's goody, also it's true. It's also true, and people, like, don't even think about the fact that when you hear a gunshot in a neighborhood that hears gunshots, you don't run towards it. You kind of put your head down and go back. Even here, where we live, where it's rural, if I heard gunshots, one, I'm not going to immediately think, oh, that's someone being shot. But two, what am I going to do running towards it?
Yeah. I'm more likely to think it's somebody, like, trying to scare off a skunk or something.
And I used to live in a building that was right next to a bar, like 200 feet from a bar, on a second story mixed use apartment building. And all the time at 2 or 3 in the morning, I would hear people yelling and screaming outside my window. It's not unusual to be in neighborhoods like that in urban environments where, like, in the middle of the night, you hear people coming home from a night out.
Yeah.
And you'll hear people yell, you'll hear people scream, you'll hear what sounds like a start maybe fighting, or a fight maybe starting.
A start maybe fighting.
And that's not an unusual thing, and you might holler at them. You're not, but you're in bed in your pajamas. Your first reaction is not, well, got to get all the way dressed and get out there and go investigate. So it's really hard. I think people just, because it sounds so sensationalized, because it was sensationalized, that 38 witnesses watched for over a half hour. It makes it sound like for 2 blocks, she was walking and getting assaulted over and over and over in broad daylight with people just staring from their windows. And then everyone went back to their Cheerios. And none of that is how it was. The first attack was the only one people could really hear. That was the only one that was on a public street. It happened very, very briefly. 10 minutes later, after she drags herself and stumbles her way into the vestibule, now there's no one that can see from the road. It's off a back parking lot.
You have to open your door in order to see what's going on.
And the people there, while they know her, are not people that are
in, like, positions necessarily of power to help.
Not everyone's there being able to rescue. And it's really, really horrible. It's a horrible situation.
That's a really sad story.
Yeah. So the man was caught. I don't want to get a whole lot into his story.
Yeah, because he's a chicken shit.
But it is kind of an odd situation because he defies most profiling.
He's just opportunistic.
Well, no, he's a married man in a career job. He worked as, like, people will say, like, a business machine operator is what kind of they call him. He would input the punch tabs for mechanical computing.
Okay.
That's, like, punch cards for computing. But he was in his job for like 10 years, had a wife and kids. He would just go out in the middle of the night and either steal people's TVs
or attack,
find people to attack.
People? Ew, he had something is wrong.
Really bad compulsions and was a bad person. He went to prison. While he was in prison, he was model behavior.
Of course he was, because then that's how he survived on the outside.
Then he shoved a can of food into his rectum to go get sent to medical.
Ugh.
They couldn't get it out, so they sent him to the hospital, where he then attacked the person transporting him, escaped, attacked multiple people in a home, and then was taken back to prison and died in prison. He's a horrible human being.
Ew.
He's a horrible human being that behaved perfectly in prison.
Yeah, because he was, that's exactly was how he didn't get caught before.
He's a horrible human being. He died in prison.
Gross.
I don't want to go too much into his story.
Okay, yeah.
But what I do want to go into is the psychology that popped up around this concept of
like the bystander stuff.
Bystander effect.
Yeah.
Because it comes up so much in true crime. And while there were a bunch of studies in the 60s and 70s about it, they're not what people think they are. So the studies that came up right after this, because of the sensationalized story, what the scientists kind of studied, they would do these studies where they took, I mean, mostly as college kids, because that's who
participates
in studies, because they're broke and they
need do you need any plasma?
They're very willing. They would put them in rooms and say, you're part of a study talking about, you know, the stresses of college life. So fill out this survey and start talking, you know, like you'll be in like a group discussion, but each person's individual in their room. And what the participants didn't know is that the other people that they heard talking were actually recordings. So they'd hear one person at a time kind of talk about their things. They would start talking, and while they were talking in the round, one of the other participants would have a medical event. They said, you know, that they would, that it was a recording of someone having a seizure or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then see if, depending on the group size, if people would
do something about
like
it,
told the person overseeing the study that someone needed help. And in smaller groups, it was more likely to happen. Like where someone would be like, if it was like a discussion with only three people, that participant was more likely to be like, hey, this guy needs help.
Yeah.
Go check on him in the other room. But when it's a study of like five or eight people, the chances of someone like going and getting help lessened or took longer.
Probably because they either assumed somebody was already going to help because, you know, somebody else is bound to, or that maybe the administrators were already aware.
Yeah. Part of the problem with that is when it's only one or two people, you don't have anyone to take social cues off of. Like, you're hearing the recording of another person start talking. You hear the medical event happening. That leaves only you.
Yeah.
So you need to intervene.
Yeah.
When it's a bigger group, but everyone else is acting calmly and just keeps going with the recording, you assume that it must be okay.
Because, you know, obviously not everybody would stay calm if...
Because they're recordings.
Yeah.
No one else was concerned. You feel like you... Maybe you just misheard what was going on. Maybe... You know, like you don't know what to do because it's a larger group.
Yeah.
And multiple studies have done similar things where I read another one study where they were in group sessions of like 3, 5, 10 people where they simulated smoke coming into the room and how often people would then go get someone being like, hey, you need to check this out. The smaller the group, the more likely someone goes out of the room and the quicker they do it. Again, no social cues when it's a small group because you're, and these ones, it was two or three, or like all the participants were in one room. But you, when there's only a couple people and you look at each other like you're unsure. You feel more personal
responsibility, yeah.
Because there's not that ambiguity about the situation you're in.
Yeah.
You see that they're a little bit nervous, you go and do it. But all it takes is one person to be a little more calm or ignore it or not see it. And it kind of lowers the group's, you know, tension on it. But also a lot of times it just takes longer. The more people there are, the longer it takes to see everyone's reactions before someone takes it upon themselves to do something.
Just like, do you remember when we bought our car?
Yeah.
That guy that came, there was a car that was coming into a parking lot right after we bought our car, and he was chasing a woman in another vehicle and was like aggressively, like scary. He wanted to hurt her.
Yeah.
And he chased her into a parking spot and she just like stayed, like kind of covered her face and stayed in her car. And he was just screaming at her and threatening her and honking his horn and just acting completely irrational. And it's interesting because, so of course, I don't think things through very well. So I got out of my car and was like, hey, you know, stop. Started yelling at him. And once I got out, people had all kind of like, we'd all noticed.
Yeah.
Nobody quite knew what to do. But as soon as I, you know, had been, I spoke up, the mom that I had made eye contact with in the car next over from me.
Yeah.
She got out and started recording because he started swearing at me and like saying he was going to hurt me.
Yeah.
And then as soon as she stepped out and started recording, another, that guy that came running over to like stop the car. And it just took that chain reaction of, okay, well, if you're going to step up, if you start this, you know, we'll each have your back in a different way. You know what I mean? It's a, it's that social ripple.
Yeah.
Because one person is not enough to handle that guy.
So
he was,
there's a couple phenomena that go on with it, which is essentially the smaller the amount, there's not a, like as much shared responsibility. If it's just me in a situation, there is no one else to answer for it.
Yeah.
I have to do something, kind of a thing. And my two options are help or not. So it's like 50% chance right there.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. But when you have two people and two 50% chances, it shrinks. Every time it shrinks just a little bit. But what a lot of people don't think about is like, we're social animals.
We follow like each other.
Like many social animals. And you can see it. Go watch some, you know, Discovery Channel and you'll watch like pack of gazelles that are clearly stressed. But if none of them start running, none of them start running. It takes one to like freak out just a little bit more than the rest.
I'm for the rest so of them to good jump at freaking into. Out a little more than the rest.
So in situations,
that's my forte.
In situations where you have people that are a little bit more laid back or just a little bit less likely to jump
or
to
want
it,
to observe a little longer or whatever. Yeah.
Or you would just have a dynamic leader in a group, someone that's clearly taking control of the situation. So in one where it's like simulated fire in a room and you have one person that clearly knows what they like, seems like they know what they're doing and they don't react to it. You're simulating it by blowing steam into the room. But if that one person's like feels more in charge and they're like,
they're going to look to them for cues and they blow it off and they're like, okay, I guess it is
everyone
okay.
Everyone else goes, oh, it's probably okay. This guy seems to know what he's doing. So there is a little bit of a bystander effect because of this delayed or like this social responsibility that's shared. There's also a kind of a like we clue in really well with people and kind of make social rules. It's why in urban environments, if you see someone that's unhoused, like most people will understand that person's unhoused. Not every single person is going to stop and go, do you need help?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of this, everyone kind of understands that person doesn't have a house. There's not a lot that all of us
individually
coming up can do. And so the best we can do is contribute as a group, which we do. And hopefully something can happen.
And also, if you want to stop and give them stuff, that's good too. Yeah,
you can help, but.
And you should do that.
The contract is like, not, but yes, if everyone was constantly stopping and offering help. Every single person, every single time.
Disrupting it their day.
There would be,
that's rude.
No, nothing would get done.
Yeah.
You know? So there's like these social rules. So I've seen experiments done trying to test the same thing where it's like an actor in an urban environment pretending they're very, very sick. You know, like laying on the ground moaning. Mm-hmm. And it takes a whole 6 minutes before someone comes up to ask if they're okay. But in that environment, there's a lot of people that go...
Well, who is that guy? He's never been here before, and he's acting really,
Or, you know, like, I mean, he's in a little bit of distress, but I'm not a medical person. I have no way of really helping him. So it takes a minute before someone feels like, oh, I have the skills to be able to help in this situation.
I gotta say, I was raised by a nurse.
Yeah.
My mom frequently stopped to ask if people needed help.
Because she has the skills. Frequently,
because she is an ER. Well, also, I think... being an ER nurse, because like there were times, like I remember being at a park once and there was a domestic dispute and my mom was like, hey, do you want to come talk to me? Like, come over here. I haven't seen you in forever. And like,
intervene.
Got into it. But I think it's just because like that's, she knows how to kind of direct that. But also I think it's just because.
It's her personality type.
Yeah, 100% her personality type.
So, I mean, there's just a lot of things that go into it. But the overall. The bystander effect is not really what people think. There's not this when there's more people, because what gets kind of stated as, especially within true crime, is like the more people that are around, the less likely anyone is to help you. You know, if you're in a big group, everyone will just watch, assuming someone else is going to. And that's not really what it is.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
In a larger group, people go, someone here must have more skills than me. And if they see anyone come up and make any kind of attempt,
then they assume that person is taking responsibility for this situation and has the skills.
And it may embolden some people to help as well. And everyone else will go, oh, it must be fine. You know?
Yeah.
Because there's so much shared responsibility. But there's an interesting study that actually came out just a little while ago with researchers in the UK and the Netherlands, where they looked at CCTV footage of a whole bunch of different situations, whether it's people in emergency situations, people that have been hurt, people in car accidents, you know, all sorts of stuff, people that have been attacked, people that, you know, just everything. The gambit from people like falling onto subway tracks and getting stuck, you know, between, you know, a train and the platform.
Yeah.
To, you know, someone just collapsing on a city street that, like, you know, had heat stroke or, you know, fainted or whatever. Aww. And how everyone around them reacts. And what they found is that really people go and help most of the time. It might take a second longer for people to process if there's danger. And it's actually more correlated to how much danger does it seem that someone's in.
Mm-hmm.
If witnesses witness a car crash, they run to help. If they witness someone fall onto train tracks, they run to help.
Yeah, you see videos of that all the time of people like working together to get down and get the person off the tracks and out of there safely before the train can come in.
Because the danger is very, very high and they know that there's not a normal situation there.
Well, and even
it's
like
not going to be typical in any circumstances.
Even in cases we've talked about, like the Yorkshire Ripper, Mo Leah.
Yeah.
She was saved because people saw what was happening and approached.
Yeah. So in
despite the fact that they knew like this man had attacked her. Yeah.
When people know that there's a high level of danger and that it's abnormal, they intercede. It happens much more often. In ambiguous situations, like someone just being sick, people are less likely to.
Because they don't want to be nosy or.
But also the danger's not that high. Someone laying on the ground moaning because they're like they hurt. If you don't know much about medical anything, are you really able to do a whole lot? Yeah. Most people go, it doesn't seem like they're in immediate danger and I can't really help. At best, I could offer them my phone, but it could be a ploy to steal my phone.
Yeah.
What can I really do? So in those ones, it's lower perceived danger, less likely for people to intervene.
Yeah.
So when you actually apply this human behavior to Kitty's story, you start to realize that one, in the first attack, someone immediately shouted out and the attacker left. For everyone else there that was a witness.
And they called the police.
Yeah. Crisis averted.
Which is what we did.
What more can they
do? With the situation in the parking lot.
Yeah. What more can I do?
They never showed.
So, you know, that level drops back down. Someone did. Like, witnesses did witness, did try to do the best they could by yelling at the attacker and calling the police. So it's one of those, like, the sensationalized headline brings about this whole trope of people witnessing. But if you take it back to, like, what the accurate headline is, woman attacked, you know, people cry out and call police. That's not, that's what should happen. Should she have gotten help sooner? Yes. Should someone have, should someone have stepped out and helped?
And said, hey, are you okay?
Yeah.
But ideally, yes.
It doesn't become a big true crime thing. Like, it doesn't become the story that it comes to if it's
without lies.
Someone was attacked and they eventually collapsed and died. Because that story is, when it does come to random attack stories, that's actually pretty typical.
Not that random attacks are typical. That's extremely unlikely. But this is a really rare situation.
But in the cases of a random attack, it kind of ending that way is not out of the ordinary. And it's a super tragic story and it has a lot of these other threads with, you know, the people that did witness and, you know, how they were treated in talking to the police and, you know, kind of everything around it.
Well, and even when they did show up, they didn't even help. That's still like, I'm still just so hung up on that they harassed Kitty's girlfriend so much.
For 6 hours,
she was interrogated and she was the prime suspect. That is so tragic.
Yeah.
And the PTSD from that. Oh my gosh.
So it's really like, at the time, it was...
It's a complex situation that got boiled down to cell papers.
New York City had something like 650 murders that year. My guess would be that if that story wasn't sensationalized, it would sound like probably a dozen other murders that year.
Yeah.
Mostly because this guy was out there doing similar things. When he admitted to her murder, he also confessed to two others, one of which someone else had already confessed to.
Oh.
So people don't really know
if that he did was much actually... more
or what. Like, those were the three he confessed to. One of them was already someone had already confessed to. So it's a weird situation, but they were also, the other ones were similar stories, just women that he was targeted, driving to attack. Attacked. He was just driving around, saw a woman, said, I'm going to attack that one, followed them until he could, and attacked them. he's an awful person that did an awful thing. But it this only becomes the story that it does and starts this wave of kind of bad psychology around
pop psychology.
Yeah. Around, you know, something that's now fairly misunderstood and gets used as a trope all the time. I mean, every single crime TV show has a similar storyline where they use this case
or a similar Law and Order definitely has a ripped from the headlines episode of this.
All the time, it's like the sensationalist thing of like, why would no one help? And it's like, no, people help. They did. They did what they thought they could. If you call out, hey, stop attacking that person, and then you watch the person stumble away from it and the other person run away from it, you assume that that's
And then you
it.
Call the police and you go, there we go.
Yeah.
I did what I need to do.
Yeah. That seems like it was done. And if you're lying in bed and you hear a commotion outside and someone yells, hey, get away from her, and then
you assume it's
quiet
been
again,
handled.
You assume it's been handled. It wasn't a bunch of apathetic people. It was people barely conscious in the middle of the night that heard a horrible event happen. And then, you know, it was a murder. That's what it was. There is one good thing that comes out of this, though. Because of that sensationalized headline, it actually was one of the triggering events for making 911 and a national phone line.
For the entire country. Knowing the situations behind those.
Yeah. So, I mean, this story was just so popular, became such a sensation because of just how trumped up it was that it
the
was
silver lining to the bullshit.
Yeah. It was one of those things where like everyone was like, you know, it would be way more convenient to just be able to dial 911 or dial a number rather than call your operator. And then you just get the precinct line with everyone else. And it's just going to be desk clerk that puts it down into a book and then radios out. And maybe or maybe not someone shows up. So, I mean,
well, that's that. Good. Usually. Boy.
Anyway.
So American justice, man.
That's your horrible story for me.
It was a horrible story. I'm so sad. Now I understand. I will say, I did read an article recently, too, that was really interesting. That kind of ties into this a little bit.
Okay.
It's titled, True Crime is Rotting Our Brains.
Oh, yeah.
It's written by Emma Berquist. It's on Gawker. The subtitle says, I would sooner get stabbed again than have someone make a podcast about me. Which I was like, okay, I do need to read this. It's really good.
Good.
It's a really good article. It definitely gave me room to try to adapt still.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that it's important to discuss true crime in a certain way.
Yeah.
It's important to increase awareness of certain cases. It's important to understand why something happened so it doesn't happen again, or that we can, you know, try to prevent it from happening that way again. But what it's not supposed to be is, it's not supposed to make you constantly feel scared of the person next to you, or that like somebody walking near you is a threat to your safety. Because we do talk about stories like this, where this is a truly tragic situation where someone really did randomly attack a person. That is such an unlikely event.
Yeah.
It's so rare, but that's why we hear about it so much, is because it is so rare that it's talked about relentlessly.
That's, it's difficult for me with a lot of true crime stuff because I always want to interrupt other people talking about stuff to just be like, no, but see, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's very uncommon.
And unfortunately, the only reason it goes on so long is actually because people are very bad at investigating. Like, very bad at investigating.
Well, and there comes a certain point where it's like, if you are invading privacy or creating entire storylines, like if you're basically writing fan fiction about a case that really happened, like that's obviously not appropriate, but especially with the constantly living in fear because you are consuming so much true crime content.
Yeah.
It makes me think about how important it is to, yes, be aware that these things happen and be aware for our neighbor's sake and to speak up for those around us and to, you know, err on the side of caution. Obviously, I'm not saying call the police every time you think that there's some possible suspicious thing happening, because that's how we end up with people getting killed that don't need to be killed.
Yeah.
But I am saying we need to be aware of our communities, and that does not mean living in fear. And I hadn't thought about that specifically until I had read this article. So I encourage you read that article. It's really interesting. It's food for thought.
That speaks a lot to the dichotomies I see that kind of turn me off to true crime, mm-hmm. which is the blood and guts for entertainment kind yeah. of side, where people get into too many nitty gritty details.
Or they dissect things that, like, they're like elements that are unrelated, and you're yeah. sensationalizing things that don't need to be sensationalized.
Sensationalizing it for the titillation. That
yes.
disturbs me, and I don't like it. I don't like when people, or I don't enjoy listening to content that seems to be profiting in some way by making entertainment that is sensationalizing people's real lives mm-hmm. in a way that's destructive, where they're more into going over these details, but at the end, they don't have a way to help or stop or bring any kind of awareness to anything at all.
Well,
they won't even mention
any let's kind of be awareness. Honest too, like where the line we tread is very fine, and I'm sure we yeah. wobble.
Oh, for sure.
But it is part of being so fascinated by the psychology of true crime is understanding both our role as a society and how we should be protecting, you know, our neighbors and each other, but also how we should be protecting ourselves and like our mental health and our state of being and our safety.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just interesting. I thought to tie it in a little bit. Maybe it's kind of a hard, hard transition, but it did tie in and you should read it.
I like that, because that's the other side that I dislike about true crime that I see often, that we're trying to like float in this middle ground between, is the people that are, it's fear porn. It's mm-hmm. wanting to have people constantly clutching pearls and scared of everyone around them. That's another one where, especially when it's talking, when people talk in depth about things like this, you know, the bystander effect of where it's pop psychology. They don't really go into like all the effects mm-hmm. inside there, all the things that can affect it. Instead, it's kind of like, and you should be horrified to be in an urban environment because people will just watch you get hurt and no one will help you.
Well, and she talks about the article.
Yeah.
Author. She talks about when she was attacked.
Yeah.
That the next person to come upon her immediately helped her.
Yeah.
And called 911 and stayed with her until she got medical support, and that there are far more people like her than the person who attacked her. And I just wanted to kind of leave that as the final note, because I want to make sure people remember that, like, there's far more, you are far more likely if you are in danger to have somebody speak up for you than not.
Yeah.
And I hope that you also remember that you are one of the people in a position to speak up should that occur to you.
Yeah. I really like that, because it is something people need to remember. The reason why cases kind of stick out is either because they've been sensationalized or because they are the one-off, mm-hmm. not because it's the typical situation. And we're in a society and people are mostly good. I mean, they might be bastard-covered bastards
with yes.
bastard sinners, but, you know, they're also doing their best, struggling through the same, you know, mortal existence. And
yep.
overall, I think people try really hard to actually do something good. But you got to remember those like things. Not everyone's in a position to always be whatever, and you can help in other ways. And it's just, yeah. Shouldn't all just be
that was a porn. Super bummer. I'm still very bummed. But I do have a good story for you.
Oh, could you please lighten the mood?
Yes. For me? Okay. So we got some Halloween candy corns, and I can't remember what flavors were in it, but it was like just awful flavors.
Not candy and corn flavors.
Not candy corn flavors. I didn't choose these, clearly. But Big and Little were with me. I had a little bit of a mom day with them, and they were eating them. And Little goes, "This one tastes like if you lick your hands after you washed them with soap and there's still a little bit of soap on your hand." And Big was like, "Ew, gross, you do that?" And Little goes, "No." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, this highly specific reference point. You've never done this."
I mean, I'm glad that they're washing their hands.
Yeah, we talked about how you shouldn't be putting your hands in your mouth or your mouth on your hands for probably another 20 minutes until the point where she was like, "Mom, I know." This is also why we mask our children. It's mostly because they need muzzles. Children are filthy.
Yeah. Man, I'm just so glad that they wash their hands. Otherwise, that's an even grosser thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
Thought that was pretty funny / gross. So don't worry, our kids aren't licking their hands and touching everything. probably.
Do you want to give everyone our social deets?
Oh man,
do you want me to do it? Because I can.
Yeah, you do it. I didn't prepare in my head.
Okay. Well, if you want to find us and follow us on Twitter, you can do that at This Is Awful Pod. I run the Twitter. I'm not very good at Twitter, because most of my time's about sports rants. I'm on my own Twitter account, and also interact with me, please, so it like gets me interacting with people. If you want to find us and follow us on Instagram, that's at This Is Awful Podcast. Allison does that. She's way better at that than me, and by way better I mean at least once a week you will get some kind of unique meme action or a reheated some post of some kind, usually about the episode that week. If you want to discuss stuff a little bit more, you can go find us on Facebook in our discussion group at This Is Awful,
a true crime podcast group. Yeah. Also,
yes,
we're doing a shirt giveaway. I forgot.
Yes, we are. Yeah,
there's a shirt giveaway that ends, what's today?
The 13th. I think this comes out the 14th.
Oh, well, it ends today. Should we extend it?
Let's extend it.
We should extend it.
Yeah, because
I was late.
Dropped the ball.
Because I'm always late on a lot of things. So yeah, we'll extend it one more week.
Perfect.
How about we do it by next episode drop?
Yes, let's do that.
So go join so you can get a shirt.
Join us on there. Comment on that post. You know, talk about stuff. Discuss stuff with us. We usually are at least somewhat active on that.
Share memes. Share fun articles.
Yeah. What's the other places? If you want to buy stuff that Allison drew on products that other people made, you can do that at shop.spreadshirt.com/this-is-awful-podcast. All the stuff from that goes to keeping our lights on. And by lights, I mean it pays for our podcast hosting. And you know,
we pay for our real lights.
Yeah. but that's, you know, all unique individual, you know, designs from Allison's brain and her hands, and they're creative and awesome.
And then they got voted on by our Patreons.
Yeah. And then if you want to support us in our causes of the week, cause of the week this week.
Okay. So for our cause of the week, safehorizon.org. Trevor and I kind of dug through that website and actually were really pumped because they offer support services to New York City, but specifically to victims of domestic violence, child abuse, rape and sexual assault, human trafficking, stalking, youth homelessness, victims of other abuse, and just general violence. Like they support survivors. Support
everyone, yeah.
I especially love that they mention stalking because that is rarely considered violence when it is violence. That is,
it can have a huge financial toll on people. Yes. I think that's one that always gets kind of written under in a lot of cases. Same with domestic abuse situations. Mm-hmm. The financial toll of having to be able to kind of go underground and move your entire life is very difficult.
So. Yeah. So the Safe Horizon is the nation's leading victim assistance organization, operating a network of programs across New York City communities and systems. They work with survivors of all forms of violence, including racism, to move from crisis to confidence. And I really liked that.
Excellent group. Yeah.
So if you would like to go donate, it is safehorizon.org. We will also put that in the show notes.
So, Allison.
Yes.
I'm sorry I bumped you out. Thanks for cheering me up.
You're welcome.
Is there anything else we need to say?
No, I think we're good. We got all the things said, and probably more than we should have said.
Yeah, probably.
That's most of this. We should have just titled this podcast "More Than We Should Have Said." Yeah, we just really appreciate all of our listeners, and it's been kind of fun watching it grow. So, thanks, guys. Remember who you are and what you stand for.
And don't die.
Bye. Love you.